Okay, you're good.
Okay, so we'll get started. What the first thing I'd like to do is invite everybody to unmute and sing four verses of a song together. And I like this song because it talks about the very thing we're going to talk about tonight. It has to do with oneness and separation. And so the first line of the song talks about, I am one and you are one. So we are each one, we're each individuals, and yet we are both one in the heart and the spirit. We're part of a bigger one, and we're oneness in a bigger oneness together. So it's that oneness and separation kind of celebrated in the song. So some of you may know the song and just belt it out, and let's sing with all our hearts. I am one and you are one and we are all together one. I am one
and you are one and we are all together one.
I'm the spirit in the heart, we are all together one. It's the spirit in the heart, we are all together one. I am one and you are one and we are all together one.
We are all together one.
In the spirit, in the heart, we are all together one. In the spirit,
in the heart, we are all together one.
I am one and you are one. We are all together one. I am one and you are one. Spirit in the heart, we are all together. In the spirit,
in the heart, we are
together one. Thank you. Nice to hear everybody's voices. So we're going to talk about Adam and Eve tonight, of all things. And the first, before I get started on that particular mythology, I want to talk about the importance of stories. And it's something that's not understood in the predominant culture. We just think, oh, we dismiss so much that's not linear and cerebral. But the truth is that the stories that we grow up with, the stories that inform the culture, inform us and guide us and provide a lot of the ruling archetypes under which we live and influence it in ways that we really, beyond imagination, it's really, they have a huge influence on us. And this particular myth is really a cornerstone myth for the predominant culture. So that's what I wanted to talk about. This is a myth that really troubled me for a long time. You know, I think for a lot of us, it was like, you know, it's the myth that lays the foundation for, you know, blaming women for everything and, among other things, and I remember being really mad about it, and I remember thinking, even as a youngster, thinking like, well, if God was omniscient, and God said to Adam and Eve, eat of this apple, God must have known they were going to do that. It seemed like a setup to me. I was a little irritated about it, and so we're going to talk about all that tonight. So the thing of it is that you can't reject a myth. And so certainly in my adult life, I've surrounded myself in a number of other myths, and my Native American heritage, I've been able to walk in that more fully as an adult, and but still, you can't get rid of a myth. And so for a long time, I was really struggling to make peace with that.
Hey, Dan, okay? I'm going to interject really quick and just ask, can everybody just double check that you're muted? There's some background noise, but it's not loud enough that I can tell who it is. So if everybody could just double check that they're muted, that would be super helpful. All right, back to you.
Okay, so the other thing I want to say about mythology is that there are many versions. And this, the Genesis story is also has much more in depth. And I'm just going to use the basic, simple story. And again, in our linear minds, we think, well, which story is the true story? You know, blah, blah, blah. People argue about it and whatever. But I just love the story of changing woman has all, among the Navajo cosmology, the story of changing woman has so many versions. And one woman asked one of the elders, one of the Navajo elders one time, well, how do you know which version to tell? And the elder smiled and said, whichever version that person is ready for. So different versions have different medicine, and yet in a mythological sense, they're all true. It's not so much either or. It's more like this version is the healing version now, and in some level they're all true. It's kind of difficult for us to comprehend that, but that's the mythological world and the world of Dreamtime. So I want to sort of talk about the story. I'm assuming everyone knows the story, but maybe I'll just tell it again. Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Paradise, and God has told them they must not eat of the apple of this one tree. And so they don't, and they're really happy, and everything's hunky-dory and all that sort of thing. And then finally, you know, they keep getting curiouser and curious about this apple. Why are we not supposed to eat that? Da, 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 da. But they stay away. And then the serpent comes along and tempts Eve and says to her, it's time, you should eat this apple. Why don't you taste it? It's really good. And so Eve has a taste, and she's like, oh, it's absolutely delicious. Absolutely the most amazing thing she's ever eaten. So she hands it to Adam and says, you must taste this. And then Adam tastes it, and then he realizes what's happened. They're thrown out of paradise and out of the Garden of Eden. They're thrown out of the beautiful garden. And they immediately feel like they must clothe themselves, and Adam gets furious because now he's no longer in paradise. He gets mad. He blames Eve. Eve turns and blames the serpent, and the rest is history. So I want to talk about what all that is about and put some different perspectives on it. Some of what I'm calling from is Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist Joseph Campbell, talked a lot about that myth, and some other people, Michael Mead, talks about it, and so these are some of the other people I'm drawing on as well as the work of Carl Jung. So there are lots of different ways to look at a myth, and so what I'm going to share is one way of looking at a myth, but the other thing is to encourage each of you to sit with this and sit with the contradictions and sit with what you know, and that's what I've done for years as well as listening to some of the mythologists. So when we think about paradise, it's a place where we're like children. We're, you know, we just follow the rules. We're simple children. We just, you know, and when I think about souls' evolutions, it could be the place of dogma, for example. It could be those early years, those early lifetimes of developing spiritually. And then the serpent comes along. The serpent is of the earth, and in India, the serpent is the kundalini. In the Eastern traditions, the serpent is that kundalini. So, and Joseph Campbell tells us that in every other mythology, the serpent is considered sacred. It's only in the Christian mythology, the Judeo-Christian mythology, that the serpent is seen as demonic, which is interesting. So the serpent talks to Eve. Another way of looking at that is to see that they've been in this paradise and they've spiritually developed, they've been in this godlike place, now it's time for them to separate out and individuate. It's time for them to take the next step and take more responsibility, to have more self-awareness. And so the kundalini begins to rise. And the reason that the kundalini comes to Eve instead of Adam, as Joseph Campbell says, it's because all things on this earth are born through woman. All things are born through the feminine. So therefore, it has to come through Eve. So the serpent comes through Eve. And that's also true within each of us individually. We all have male and female energy within us, and we express that differently on the whole continuum, male and female, and a whole beautiful continuum in between. but we all have these energies that we work with in the planet, outside of ourselves and within ourselves. So it could be the feminine within ourselves, which would be the inner self, like the Kundalini rises and we have an inner awareness before we have an external manifestation. So that's also the feminine. The feminine is also the closest to the earth, as the snake is closest to the earth. The other thing about the serpent is that the serpent is shedding the old skin and to walk in the new skin. So there's that renewal idea, the letting go of the old and walking in the new. So you can see how really this was, Eve was just following the way of Creator, and that Creator, that, you know, all the stories around the world, if you read different mythologies, and I'm sure you're familiar with this from fairy tales and so forth, like, the surest way you can know that the hero is going to eat something or do something is if it's forbidden right from the beginning, and you know that's exactly what's going to happen. So it's, Joseph Campbell says that God actually planned for Eve to eat that fruit, for Adam and Eve to eat that fruit. And making it forbidden was a guarantee that it would happen, but it would only happen when they developed to a certain degree. So Eve offers it then to Adam, who then reacts, and he becomes self-aware, and suddenly he's like, he's not in that Garden of Eden anymore. He's in a place of separation, aware of his own individuality, and with new consciousness always comes pain. I think we have that in our lives, where as soon as you leave an old consciousness and move into something new, it's always painful. Even if where you're going is more exciting, there's always a loss, there's always pain that comes with it. So Adam experienced pain. And the key here now is his reaction to that pain. Because what he did was he objected to the pain, turned, blamed Eve, got into scapegoating. So, you know, rather than take responsibility for his pain, for the fact that he took the apple from her and ate of it too, he turns and blames her. She, in turn, blames the serpent. And therein we have the problem. So one of the things about the tree and the apple, Joseph Campbell says that the apple that they ate was the apple of consciousness. One could also say it's the tree of life. So they ate from the tree of life. And they're invited to experience life more fully through that apple and the sensuousness of life. But life also includes pain. Life includes happiness and pain. It includes comfort and pain. And what we're in now is in a culture which, like, has trouble with pain. We don't know what to do with pain. We reject pain. We try and get rid of pain. We medicate pain away. We say, well, I must have created this. I must have done something wrong. And that goes right back to that myth. That whole idea that we've done something wrong goes right back to that myth. I must have eaten that apple. Oh, my God, that's why I'm in pain. Whereas actually that apple comes from the tree of life, and life has all of these cycles of pain as well as, you know, cycles of healing. So there's a blocking of life right from the beginning there. The other thing is that we're set up with the archetype of blame, and that is just so rampant right now, and a thing that we really majorly need to heal in our culture is this tendency to blame. We blame ourselves, we blame each other, we blame the politicians, we blame, rather than seeing larger patterns that are unfolding and praying for the healing and to come through. The other thing that's set there with the blame is that when Adam blamed Eve, then he blamed the feminine, and there we have that whole sense of the denigration of the feminine, but then Eve turned and blamed the serpent. And when she blamed the serpent, she's blaming the earth, because she's blaming a natural creature that's close to the earth. She's blaming the whole cycles of renewal and letting go, that whole shedding of the skin that snakes do. So blaming all the cycles of life, and so there's a whole rejection of life in their reaction. The other thing that Joseph Campbell says is that this is the only mythology where God throws them out of the Garden of Paradise and rejects them, which is also very, very interesting. So one of the ways that we can heal these kind of myths is to read other creation stories and start to make them more of ours, or to rewrite these things and work with them. But it's important to get back and work with the right brain and the unconscious, because these stories are embedded in our bodies, and we can just think about them all we want. But actually reframing and looking at this and saying, wow, you know, what an interesting reaction. I'm going to start shifting that. I'm going to see these patterns and start shifting that with myself and working with the spirits to do that. The other thing that's very interesting is a friend of mine who's Jewish spent some time in Israel, and while she was studying in Israel, she was translating texts from the Old Testament into English, and she discovered that the word that has been translated to mean sin actually literally means separation. And that's part of life as well. Separation is part of life. We're in a time of extreme separation, which is, again, you know, really you can trace back to this mythology. We're in this time of extreme separation where this mythology has formed so many of our attitudes. And even those of us who feel like nature is sacred and we're shifting those attitudes, deeply inside of us in subtle ways, we still have these lack of understandings that are much more inherent in indigenous ways. So we're always need to be asking this question of, in what way am I still separate from life and not accepting of the cycles of life? In what way am I blaming myself, blaming my body, blaming the dog for barking, you know, whatever it is? So those are questions we always need to ask ourselves, but I thought that was really fascinating. I want the other thing about life is that life is, life breaks into, so you have this oneness that then breaks into the two. And that's a big part of many creation stories as well, the oneness that breaks into the two. And when we have the oneness break into the two, there's a whole other dynamic that happens. But the two can also go back into oneness. There's this dance back and forth of separation and oneness and separation and oneness that's part of life. And there is this polarity in life, which, because we're so polarized as opposed to dancing in the duality, we tend to think of that as separate. We want to think of ourselves as oneness, oneness, oneness. But when we do that, we're polarized, and we're not acknowledging the separateness, and then we're polarized in oneness. But if we acknowledge the separateness, as the song says, I am one and you are one, and together we are both one together. So there is that dichotomy of the oneness in each of us, and then the oneness in our separateness, and the one we are one and we are together one. So I want to read something about the number two. This is from the Druidcraft Tarot, which I just love. I've learned so much from it. To create movement, development, change, and evolution, the one needs to polarize itself into two. This idea is depicted in many indigenous religions and in various types of paganism as deity manifesting as a goddess and a god whose interactions create the universe and all of life on earth. At a personal level, being alone can bring us in touch with a sense of wholeness and oneness, but it could also lead to loneliness or stagnation. Once we enter into relationship with another, in whatever way, experience and change is the result. Sometimes this feels positive and creative, at other times negative and destructive. So you can see how this breaking into the two creates all this dynamism and experience and relationship and creativity. The interplay between the two poles of the original one is the dance of creation, celebrated in Wicca and Druidry, Taoism and alchemy. The experience of the dance is not always easy, but it is rich and ultimately fulfilling. So reframing that whole thing, I think, has just been so healing for me, that whole idea of, like, that they were really supposed to eat that, that when the kundalini rises, there is this breaking out. And I think of India, I mentioned this before, the dance of Shiva and Shakti. When Shiva and Shakti dance together, the two, male and female, the goddess and the god, Shakti is the goddess and Shiva is the god, and when they dance together and they're in oneness, all of creation is born, and then they separate out and dance apart. And life is like that. We often think, well, we want to be in oneness, and we meditate to be in oneness, but we're meant to move into that oneness and have the meditation and then go out and dance life to its fullest. And often we dance way out to the edges. And so, and then we come back to center. But we're not actually even always meant to be centered all the time. And this idea that we're supposed to be centered and this judgment about not being centered often can be very confusing to us. But the more that we are centered, the more we have something to come back to as we dance out. We can take that centeredness out to the edge. But it's where we dance out to the edges in life and live life fully that we really grow and experience spirit. Any questions so far? Comments?
No questions yet. Nope.
Okay. So I want to tell a different creation story now. This is a Native American story, and very different. So in this story, Sky Woman falls from a hole in the sky. The great goddess, called Sky Woman, falls from a great hole in the sky. And before she has left her realm in the sky, she has grabbed a bundle of seeds, which she clutches close to her. Below her, far, far below her, there is only a realm of dark water. in which there are some water animals, but it's just all dark water. She falls and falls for a long time. So again, we have that idea of the fall. You think about, often that term is used in relation to Genesis, the idea of falling from grace. So she's falling from the sky, and there's only water below. She falls and falls. Two geese see her, and in order to help her, to make her landing more gentle, they fly up, and together they join together to carry her, and then they fly her down and bring her down to the water, and then they are holding her on their back. They're on the water now, and they're holding her on their back. But the geese begin to tire. So soon other animals take turns holding Sky Woman. The fish come and hold her for a while. The beavers come. The loons come. And then the turtle comes and says, "You can rest on my shell." And so there she finds the most solid resting place is on the turtle. But then there becomes an awareness that Sky Woman needs land. The animals all discuss among themselves, Sky Woman needs more land. And one of the animals recalls that there's mud at the bottom of the water, way, way, way down at the very, very bottom. And many of the animals volunteer, one after another, they volunteer, "I will go down and get that mud." They volunteer, they try their best, and one by one, each of them fails. Finally, Muskrat volunteers, and all the other animals think, "Oh, Muskrat is not so good at going so deep. I don't know how Muskrat will do." But they had all tried, and Muskrat insisted, and so Muskrat was given a chance. And Muskrat went down, 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 so deep down. And Muskrat was gone for so long, the other animals began to despair. "He's drowned. He's not coming back. Muskrat is gone. Muskrat is surely drowned. So, so long." But then Muskrat comes back, and Muskrat has in his paw this mud from way, way down at the depths. But Muskrat is so exhausted from the journey that he dies as he brings, just at the last, he dies. And so he sacrifices his life that Sky Woman could have land, so that there could be land. So the mud is placed on Turtle's back, and then Sky Woman begins to sing and dance on Turtle's back. Singing and dancing on Turtle's back. Singing and dancing on Turtle's back. The animals join in, and pretty soon they're all singing and dancing together. And as they sing and dance, their singing and their dancing feeds the mud, and the mud begins to grow until there's land, and the great continent is formed. And that is a continent that we all live on, that the indigenous people call Turtle Island. Then Changing Woman, Sky Woman takes her bundle that she has clutched close to her with all the seeds, and she begins to spread the seeds on the land. And then she tends the seeds and the little seedlings as they come up. And soon there are plants, and more animals come as there's food to eat. And thus the land is born. So how different this story is, in which nature comes, and it's all a joint effort. Nature is part of the partner. There's a fall, just as there is in Genesis, but it's a fall to a different creation. There's nothing negative in the fall. And in fact, there is this idea that we have this idea, the other thing about some of those traditions coming out of Genesis and so forth, is this idea of like the upward God. God is in the sky. And yet this is a goddess that drops down and brings all life. And when the muskrat goes way, way down for the land, it's also teaches us about, if we want the mud that feeds life, then we must go down into the depths of our soul. And that's the way of the goddess, is down, down in the inner realms, and then up and out afterwards. And so after we go do that inner work, then the light is born from that inner world. And there are many, many symbols and so forth that we work with in ceremony in Native America that talk about that, and maybe a little later we'll get to that. Lauren, you want to read that part from Braiding Sweetgrass?
Yes. So this is from the book Breeding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And if you don't know this book, I recommend knowing this book. On one side of the world were people whose relationship with the living world was shaped by Sky Woman, who created a garden for the well-being of all. On the other side was another woman with a garden and a tree. But for tasting its fruit, she was banished from the garden, and the gates clanged shut behind her. That mother of men was made to wander in the wilderness and earn her bread by the sweat of her brow, not by filling her mouth with the sweet, juicy fruits that bend the branches low. In order to eat, she was instructed to subdue the wilderness into which she was cast. Same species, same earth, different stories. Like creation stories everywhere, cosmologies are a source of identity and orientation to the world. They tell us who we are. We are inevitably shaped by them, no matter how distant they may be from our consciousness. One story leads to the generous embrace of the living world, the other to banishment. One woman is our ancestral gardener, a co-creator of the good green world that would be the home of her descendants. The other was an exile, just passing through an alien world on a rough road to her real home in heaven. And then they met, the offspring of Sky Woman and the children of Eve, and the land around us bears the scars of that meeting, the echoes of our stories. They say that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and I can only imagine the conversation between Eve and Sky Woman. Quote, sister, you got the short end of the stick.
Sister, you got the short end of the stick. So we've been living at the short end of the stick, but we are coming out of that, especially as more of these other creation myths are coming forward. So, So one of the things I want to talk about is how this has affected our relationship to our bodies. Because as we blame the earth and as we are separate from the earth, and there's a separation that happens in the Sky Woman story as well. She separates out of the sky and down to the earth. But there isn't this, there's this embracing of life. There's all life. And so instead of embracing the apple, embracing the tree, being grateful to the serpent, we've moved in the opposite direction. And when we reject the tree of life, when we reject the fruit of life, when we reject the serpent, we reject the earth, we reject our bodies. And, you know, certainly in Catholicism, there was a lot of scourging of the body, and the body was the enemy. And so that's part of the history that we're coming out of as a result of this myth. But it's still, even though we don't scourge our bodies anymore or say we hate our bodies in that way or the body's evil, we still, in more subtle ways, are still living in that way and out of that myth in that way. When women say, and I'll talk about it specifically in women's bodies since it's particularly Eve and the feminine that was denigrated in that myth, is when we no longer have the sense of the sacredness of our bodies, either male or female, and all our bodies are sacred, both the masculine and the feminine. In many cultures, in fact, the masculine and feminine were very much honored as sources of life. Very, very different. Again, more like the Sky Woman story, where life is more honored. And so the phallus is really honored, and you can see it on, you actually see a man and a woman making love on some of the Mayan and East Indian temples, because it's a place from which life springs, and so it's seen as sacred. You'll see some places that are really considered sacred because they have a natural phallic, in the way they appear in nature is very phallic, and so they're seen as very sacred places, or places that are very inner, caves and so forth, that feel very very much like the vagina, the vaginal opening that that brings in the phallus to allow for life. So those kinds of places are seen as very sacred. There's a really great CD by Jennifer Berezon called Returning to the Mother. It's done in a cave in Bali, I think it is. It's so beautiful. I can't recommend it enough. And the song is, the whole CD is with this one chant, which is Returning to the Mother. I'll sing a little bit of it. Returning, returning, returning to the mother of us all. So she and three other women sing that chant through the whole CD. But the other three women are of different nationalities. One's African, one is East Indian, and then Sharon Birch, who is Navajo. And so they sing that chant together for a bit, and then one of them comes in with a sacred chant. I think, I don't remember which is first, perhaps the African woman comes in and sings her chant, an African chant, over that underlying chant, and then she fades out, and then one of the other women comes in and sings for her chant over that returning to the mother chant, and that goes on until all three of them have done that. It's so beautiful. It's in this cave in Bali that was considered very sacred. So here we have a really different connection. There's both masculine and feminine, and the body generally and the earth generally are considered sacred. And this is very much informed by the mythologies that that govern the culture, that inform and govern and create the culture, really. Our creation myths create our culture and create our thinking. So the way that works for us in women's health is in traditional indigenous societies, women's bodies are seen especially sacred. The Navajo talk about women's bodies as being a source of hope, and how the black is a color of hope because it's the color of the uterus, the emptiness and the void of the uterus. It's always hold hope. One Navajo man said, you know, for us, women are hope. We would never, in the old days, we would never think of abusing a woman. Like, why would you do that? It would be like abusing hope. Like, why would you do that? It was incomprehensible to him. So it's very different. Like, the feminine is always the renewing principle. The feminine is that place that that is the renewing feminine that always gives birth. So, but and so women's cycles are seen as very sacred in these traditions throughout the world. I know about it from my own Lakota tradition, in which when a woman comes out of her moon, she separates herself out. Traditionally, you know, Native culture is as disrupted as everybody else right now, but you'll still see that around ceremony time and so forth. And oftentimes, you'll still see that in women will just say, "I'm on my moon. I'm going to take some space here," and then the rest of the community honors that. Their partners honor that, and there's an understanding that that's sacred. And what's understood in that is that when we move on to our moon time, many women feel like, I get so irritable. I just want everyone to leave me alone. And that's actually not, that's only symptomatic of the fact that we lack our ceremony. It's actually part of it. It's like if we don't get that sacred space to go into those inner realms, then we will start demanding it unconsciously through irritability. There's a pull to inwardness that comes with moon time that's very sacred. Indigenous cultures understood the sacredness of those shifts that are happening in the body, in the earth's body, because we're connected to that, more connected to that by our stories and by as much as anything. And so women are given time, and it's understood that the veil is thinner. And so we think, God, I'm so sensitive when I'm in that PMS and on my moon, I'm so sensitive. Well, sensitivity is not necessarily a bad thing. That physical sensitivity is happening because the veil is thinner and we can hear the spirits better. We have a much closer connection to spirit. I was in my office years ago, and I was working with a woman who had the menstrual cycles from, you know, it was unbelievable what she went through. Just so hard. And so I started talking to her about, and she was very strict Christian, and I started talking to her about our Lakota tradition after I got to know her better, and we were working together and so forth. And I said to her, I said, you know, we have this understanding, and I explained to her what I just explained to you. And then I said, we feel that women need to take this time apart. And she had terrible, like she loved her family, but during that period of time, she hated them. She didn't want them anywhere near her. All her symptoms were extremely exaggerated. And I said, you know, we have this understanding among the Lakota and among many indigenous peoples that the reason that women feel that way is because we need to be separate. We need to be separate and take that time because we can hear God better when we're on our moon time. And she practically jumped across the room at me and said, I've always known I could hear God better when I was on my period. And nobody was more surprised than me. She came from a completely different tradition without any of those kind of teachings. And yet inside of her, in her intuition, in her inner world, and in her body, she knew what was true. So what we have instead is we're blaming our hormones. Oh, it's just my hormones. It's just my hormones. It's just my hormones. To me, that's blasphemy when women say that. It's just my hormones. You know, we dismiss all this wisdom that's trying to come through. And sometimes it's chaotic. A lot of feelings that, you know, women, we can get away with suppressing our feelings for 3 weeks out of the month, but boy, that one other week is the time of truth. The feelings need to flow. And that's part of the feminine, too. And in other cultures, again, we do not suppress and control our feelings so much. We let them flow. And rather than saying, oh, it's just my hormones, we might say, ah, my hormones are speaking to me. Something sacred is going on here. And maybe it's a toxin that needs to be discharged, but it's still those hormones, are not, we denigrate them. And that comes, we can trace that right back to that myth. It's like the earth and therefore the body, and it's all to do with women. And by nature, the feminine is more chaotic because the feminine is so much about the cycles of rebirth, of shedding the old skin and then rebirth. And so it's much more about change. The feminine is much more about change. Carl Jung once said that that to the male psyche, the feminine can feel quite disruptive. And men really, the male psyche, this is what Jung said, the male psyche needs a lot of order and likes things to be kind of more like regular. And he said, you know, women don't realize it, but when men come home and the women have rearranged the furniture, it's extremely chaotic to the man, you know. But that's a creative force. When the woman is rearranging the furniture, something as simple as that, which was the example that Jung used, is can feel very chaotic to the male, but it's actually it's a creative force of the feminine. So now, what is true right now is if you look at things from a naturopathic or a medical point of view, one might say, well, there are all these hormonal imbalances and so forth. But I can tell you as a naturopath, I don't look to see, like, if people are high in estrogen or progesterone or measure all that sort of thing. I look to see at why are the hormones out of balance. And the reason they're out of balance is because we don't live as islands. We live all together. And what happens on the whole earth affects each of us. And so our hormones are out of balance because the whole earth is out of balance. So we may feel more depressed or more irritable or have, premenstrual breast tenderness or excessive bleeding, menopausal hot flashes, all different kinds of things, problems in pregnancy that we didn't see before. But that reflects an imbalance. And we can still sit with those feelings and sit with that process. And I'll talk about that ceremony in just a minute. But that reflects, what we're feeling reflects the problems in the earth with whom we really are one. And so what I look at when I'm treating women is I look at the problems are in the endocrine system being poisoned. So the liver, which breaks down the hormones, is unable to do so as efficiently because it's overloaded with all these other toxins. And then we also have so many of these toxins are neuroendocrine disruptors. So they're actually disrupting adrenal function and thyroid function and all of that sort of thing. And so, again, it's not the hormones per se. It's the toxic environment that we're in. And part of that toxic environment has to do with not honoring the feminine. And the feminine is so different than the feminine is a creative force. The feminine is more inclusive and all-embracing. The masculine is about discernment, which we need both, because if you have only the feminine, then you're just merging and there are no boundaries. So the masculine gives boundaries. The masculine is more about separation and discernment. The feminine is about feeling, emotion, intuition. It's about the heart. The masculine is about logic, linear, cerebral, head, differentiation. The feminine is closer to the earth, and women are close to the earth. Women are by nature, native people say that all the time, that women are closer to the earth, and women are closer to spirit, because our very nature of our physical bodies brings us more into inner realms, and it's the inner realms in which we connect with spirit. So as we have moved to a male-dominated culture, and we are more of an extroverted culture, we're all focused on doing and getting things done and being more extroverted. And the feminine is much more introverted. So as we, and more about introversion, looking within and connecting within, which our moon time is a great opportunity to do that. When among indigenous peoples on Turtle Island, anyway, when women come onto our moon time, we do not go into other ceremonies. And sometimes people who do not, women who don't know any better think that's really sexist. But in reality, it's not. It's honoring that ceremony that's there. And what's interesting in being in Native communities is often how much women relish that power and look forward to the Moon Lodge, because it's such a quiet, deep space. Your meditations, our meditations are much deeper at that time. It's really treasured and not seen at all as a negative thing. Questions or comments so far? That's kind of a lot I've talked about there.
Yeah. Here's one. This one, there's a couple questions in there, but in here, but I'll just read it and you can take it where you take it.
Okay.
So falling brings both good and bad, but it brings something gained. Like Adam and Eve brings awareness, Sky Woman brings the earth and land. Is awareness of the land and its energy and learning to be one with it the key to fully understanding and thus healing ourselves? And then should all women stand in their power? We are sacred and life comes from us. How do we gain and stand in this power, and is it required to fall?
God, that's a lot of questions. I think I could do a whole weekend on that. Actually, this whole talk is a weekend talk. I feel like I'm on fast forward doing it. Falling is that, you know, what's interesting is in spirituality, we look at the Star of David, which is two triangles put together. And one is an upward-facing triangle, and the other word is a downward-facing triangle. And so we all have falling that happens in our lives. In mythology, falling can be about falling down into the depths of our soul, falling into the depths of our pain, falling into the depths of, you know, and so and the dark night of the soul, what's termed the dark night of the soul, really difficult times that are initiatory times for us. And everyone has times like that, falling into financial ruin, whatever it is, but there's that falling. And in a patriarchal culture, we do not honor falling. That's considered failing. We only honor success, and there's this idea of this linear upward mobile thing that that is working in our culture economically or sociologically at all. But falling is actually a great opportunity, and life is full of fallings and what we call successes and failures, if you will, without putting judgment on the word failure, like, well, I tried this and that's not working, or it worked for a while and now it's not working. And so the falling is, you're right, falling is absolutely sacred, and because falling brings us down into those deeper inner realms. And pain, the pain of separation from where we were once before, the pain from separation from the light and the joy of where we were before, the pain from separation from the light that we feel even in our spiritual practice or meditation pushes us into that dark night of the soul. But there is tremendous growth in that. I think of the pond lily, which is in the same genus as the eastern lotus, which is so revered over there. And the pond lily, the roots, it's the roots that are used for medicine. And in order to gather the roots, you have to go through this mucky, you know, pond. You have to go into a pond, which is just mucky, to gather those roots, and it's quite an experience. And yet those mucky, all that muck and guck of the pond the roots thrive in, the quiet pond lily or lotus that rests so quietly on the top with its petals open and receptive is fed by all the muck of life. And by all that muck of the inner process underneath that water. So you're right, falling is really, and falling can take us into a more awareness. If we don't survive, if we don't get some more awareness in that. But a lot of it is not so much figuring it out and understanding it, but as it is just experiencing it. Like the thing about eating of that apple and Robin Kimmerer puts it so well in the reading that Lauren just shared with us about tasting the fruit and relishing in the fruit. Jung once said, similarly, life is not to be analyzed, it's to be experienced. So for us to be in our power, it's really to like enjoy, be in our power with our bodies, be in our power with loving our bodies. Sometimes being in our power has nothing to do with opening our mouth. Feminine power is much more about being than doing or saying. So it might be like, I am daring to love my body. I am daring to have a sensual experience with my body. That's powerful. That is revolutionary in these times, to simply love our bodies. Does that answer the question? You can unmute yourself so we can dialogue, actually. I really like it when people do that with their questions.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Did I answer the whole question? There was so much there.
You did. It
It made me feel good about a few things. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you. I love the dialogue because then I know, are you just helping you guys? You know, yeah. Before we get to the next question, I want to talk a little bit about moon time and how I prescribe it for my patients. And actually, it's the only cure I know for dysmenorrhea. Painful menstrual cramps, I think, are a sure sign of someone once described them as blocked power. And I think it's the cramping against being forced to be out in the world and be external and be in the masculine. And it's just screaming of our uterus to just like be appreciated and loved and be heard, and for us to pull into that sacred power of the inner realms, which is just being with our feelings and processing. And it's messy, you know, like the roots of the pond lily, but it's beautiful and it's nourishing. So one of the things I have women do is we can't exactly in our modern world say, I'm on my moon, and take off for 3 days. But what we can do is we can take extra space at that time. So maybe I could get off work early that day. Maybe I could have somebody else take care of the baby that day. Maybe I could have somebody else cook for me or order out or something. But the main thing is to take some extra space for meditation and for being with your body. And what I recommend is using some St. John's wort oil, which was considered very spiritually protective. I found it to be amazingly spiritually protective for the first and second chakra areas. And in Europe, women on their the pagan women in Europe used the oil of St. John's wort on their labia during moon time for spiritual protection. So that's the other reason, because we're more open, we're also more vulnerable during that time. And vulnerability is a power. We don't think of vulnerability as a power, but vulnerability helps us to be more open and receptive, and it also helps us to connect more. If you think about the times when you've connected most deeply with somebody else, it's been when we've both been vulnerable with one another. When we can both be vulnerable with one another, that's where we have really deep connection. There's tremendous power and beauty in vulnerability, and it's part of life. So we want to open and embrace our vulnerability, but at the same time, we have to bring protection. So St. John's wort was put on the labia to help to protect us during that time when we're so much more open. What I often recommend is that women put a little bit of St. John's wort right over the uterus area and work with it however we're comfortable, and then to actually go into a meditation as often as possible during that period of time when we're full on our moons. And women will feel it. Oftentimes women would choose to go into the moon lodge around ceremony. When I was pouring water for lodges and so forth, women would say, you know, I feel that pull now, even though I'm not bleeding yet. I would say, go to the moon lodge. You know, listen to yourself. Listen to that inner realm. It's not just about, you know, the men say, oh, it has to be 24 hours before you're bleeding and 24 hours after, and that always makes me laugh because it's like, she comes when she's going to, and sometimes she gives warning and sometimes she doesn't. I'm thinking, only a man would have invented that rule. And so we often laugh together about that. But women know, we all know that in our bodies, and so we listen to that. And just to take time, and what I recommend is actually doing the falling, doing the downwards triangle, and where many meditations were encouraged to go up, follow that kundalini energy up into the third eye. In this, we go down into the first and second chakras and really hold our uterus and meditate with the uterus and bring love there and process the feelings and so forth that come up, do some journaling, pay attention to our dreams at that time. But just begin to use that time to practice with being in the inner realms and invoking whichever goddesses we feel the most comfortable with to work with at that time. So there's no real structure to it. It's just about being with that in a good and sacred and loving place. And if feelings of anger at the body come up, then we bring those into the compassionate heart and we bring compassion to them. Because those are cultural things that have come from centuries of myth that are taught that dislike our bodies and feel resentful of our bodies. And all that is the toxins coming up that need to be processed and released and brought forward in compassion. Okay, there was another question?
There's another question. It's kind of will take us on a different track. So I don't know if you wanted to go there or not.
Let me check my notes and see if I'm ready for a different track. I want to talk about animals. Don't let me forget to get back to that. Okay. No, go ahead. Let's go on a different track.
Well, actually, before we go on that track, I have there's another animal question that came through. This is somebody who kept getting kicked off the call. And her question was, so she missed some stuff. Was there a significance, like a lesson or a metaphor in the story where the muskrat died?
Yes, thank you. That's a really good question. That talks about how, and this gives me the chills. It's so exciting. But that talks about how life feeds life. And in order for us to live, something has to die. So it's still that serpent thing, you know, it's that in order for us to live, something has to die. And even if we're vegan, every time we pick a carrot out of the ground, that carrot gives its life that we may live. So that's really woven in that story, and it's so beautiful. It's like the muskrat gives his life that there may be a bigger life. The turtle island can be created, and he gives his life, that little muskrat gives his life, so that larger life can be born. And so that has tremendous significance. And we've gotten away from that, and I think there are a number of reasons why we don't like that idea. One is we've gotten away from the cycles of life because of this myth. And we, you know, we think, well, that's painful, and pain isn't good because of this myth. Pain is neither good or bad. Pain just is. It's how we relate to it. It's an opportunity. It's a crisis and an opportunity. And that doesn't mean that people should be allowed to be in pain, but neither should we be just medicating away all of our pain. We need to learn again how to process with it and move with it and go into it. And life is about loss, but life is always about something giving away that we may live. So the other reason is that we have really senseless, terrible sacrifices that are happening on this planet. And one of them is when I think about all these beautiful men and their warrior spirits, these young men who are called to go to these senseless wars. And it really takes advantage of these men make tremendous sacrifices from pure hearts oftentimes. And the sacrifices of their life and often their well-being and the wounds that they're left with if they survive are huge. And it's not for a good cause, necessarily. I'm going to remove necessarily. The wars are not for a good cause. It's not like they're using that warrior energy to go out and hunt to bring food back. They're not going out to protect their families. It's not, they're not going out. It's all about corporate greed. So that, I think that and many other examples like that are why we've moved away from the idea of sacrifice of life or sacrifice as a positive thing or as part of life, because it's been so warped. But if you take the example of George Floyd, that man, though by no conscious choice, and so many before him, that the building blocks of foundation, when it finally happened with that man, it's like he lost his life, but it's a huge sacrifice. And yet he's like the muskrat, which it's like his loss actually is feeding this huge movement, which in the end we are all hoping, and I'm quite confident, will create tremendous change so that those kinds of things will cease to happen on this planet, not only to black people, but to all people everywhere, to women, to native people, to anyone, and to animals as well, that we can bring back this, like, what a heinous sacrifice to have to make that. And yet that's a sacred thing. It's that we may also look at his death as a sacred thing, a tremendous sacred giveaway that is serving all people. And we wish that it would not have happened in that way. It's certainly a senseless and destructive death. And yet in this situation, because people are recognizing the hugeness of his sacrifice and honoring that giveaway and honoring that sacrifice, it becomes life-giving. And there we go back to, like, honoring that sacrifice, even if it was senseless, it's bringing out the senseless and the horror, and so there's a healing that comes, and a new life is born out of it. Does that make sense? Can I have that person unmute?
Yes, thank you so much, because when you first told the story, you were saying that you have to dive deep, you know, to get into the feminine, to kind of like work through yourself, but then it's like when you come up, you die. So I'm like,
when you come up,
first understanding
die.
Was
Well, you were saying that when you have to do some transformation work, you have to dive deep. The work is diving deep into the feminine. But then when the muskrats come up, he dies. So I'm like, I didn't want to. When I first thought about it, like, then why would you want to go down deep? Because when you come up, you die, you know?
I love
the perspective that you just told, because it actually makes more sense about life, giving life, and how, you know, with the example of the George Floyd, that one life can spark a bigger movement, and it makes much more sense, because before I was shrinking away from being a muskrat, but now I'm like, oh, sometimes you have to be a muskrat in order to ignite a movement.
Yes, and you know, the other thing is that when myths talk about death, they're not necessarily talking about physical death. So the muskrat, you could also say the muskrat lost who he was because of his or her, I'm using the pronoun his, but because of the deep dive, when we make that deep dive into the, you know, even if we just go, it doesn't have to necessarily be as deep as is in this myth, but we go within in our moon time, or we stop and take time to go within and take that, you know, a bit of a dive into our feelings or whatever it is, there's a certain death that happens. We're not the same. Like, there's a certain death that happens, and when we come back, we're reborn different, and so there's a death there. So myths won't necessarily differentiate that, but when you listen, when you hear about death in a story, it can be a death preceding a rebirth, or that there's, like, the muskrat could never be the same after that journey. No way could that muskrat be the same. That's going to be a transformative journey. And so the myth could be suggesting that, in fact, you know, muskrats aren't extinct, and so it could be that that muskrat actually is, you know, died to who he was and is now someone very different. So thank you. That's a very good question. Yeah, not wandering from it at all. Any other questions?
Yes.
I have a question. I emailed my question in, so I'm wondering if maybe I could just have a dialogue instead.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I don't know if it was my turn, though.
Oh, I guess it is. Is it her turn?
Okay. We have one on email, but Dancing Crow, if you want to go live, then go for it.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, great, because actually I emailed my question, but if this ties into what you've talked about. Ooh, okay, so first I want to say thank you so much. This has been timely and poignant, and I'm just really, really grateful to be able to listen and to be able to ask you this question, or these just maybe one or two questions. So going back to Adam and Eve, I did want to comment. I've studied a lot of Kabbalah and things like this, and there are some schools of thought that believe that the apple or the tree of knowledge was a psychedelic, because that's also how humans were able to, like, develop language. And, like, as you know, that's how we learn things that are unseen in this realm. So just wanted to add that. And I also had just learned about ecofeminism, which is also the concept that until the rights of women and the earth are taken seriously, that, like, the human race cannot be healed. So it's a concept that women and the earth are inextricably tied. Both have been conquered by men, both have been depleted, exploited, and they both give birth. So coming from there, I am, you know, Hispanic, Latina. I took your class at NCNM a long time ago. And so I've been on this new app called TikTok, of all things. And I'm finding so many indigenous girls, Latinas, Mexican people. And it breaks my heart, because a lot of them have been told that they have no right to learn the culture of their ancestors. And so what I have found is that a lot of them are calling themselves witches and practicing Wicca, which is great. I also practiced Wicca for a very long time. But the term witch comes from the Spanish Inquisition, and it was the term that was used for healers. It was the term, so if you were a shaman, a healer, a herbologist, you are now a witch. And so it kind of breaks my heart to see a lot of these young healers kind of, and it's a fine path, it's an okay path, but a lot of them think that they're restricted from learning the old ways. And so I was wondering, how can we explain to people, like, we're responsible for conserving the ancestors' knowledge. If not us, then who? And how can we empower these Black and brown women, mostly women, there are some men, and trans people, of course, non-binary. So how can we empower them to claim their ancestry and not be bullied into thinking that the knowledge is restricted or things like that? And I do feel like that ties into the whole Christianity kind of aspect of, oh, that's magic. And it's like, this isn't magic. This is spiritual. It's the old way. And so I would really love to hear your thoughts.
Wow, that's a lot. I hope I can...
Sorry, was that a lot?
No, it is. It's just like, whoa. Oh,
I'm sorry.
I want to thank you for that bit from the Kabbalah. You know, I'm a student of mythology, and I often wished I could read that and read so many other things and sit at the foot of elders and listen to more stories. And so I really appreciate everyone's different point of view is so beautiful on mythology because there are every point of view has merit. So I love the whole psychedelic idea because it is an awakening. There was an awakening in which they went, whoa, you know. So, yeah, I love it. Thank you. That's a really great insight. I just love it. Yeah, ecofeminism, that's been something that has been talked about for quite a long time, that idea of that the women and the fate of the earth and the fate of women have been intricately connected for probably always. And if you follow history, actually, like as people move further away from honoring the earth, then you can see the way that we treat the earth is how we also treat women, and it's been historically it's been intricately connected. So during the burning times, for example, not just the Spanish Inquisition, but all through Europe and then over here into this country, and then it was taken to third world countries, this burning primarily of women healers, and these were healers that were close to the land. And in some places it was like you get burned for growing basil, and in some places you just got burned for being a woman, even if you were just a girl or even a girl baby. So, there's that whole connection with the earth and the mother, or the Mother Earth I'm getting ahead of myself because I'm getting excited. The whole connection between the feminine and women and the earth that needs to be reclaimed. And we need to be, and it doesn't exclude men, it doesn't make us better than men, but it's time that we honor that is our medicine, that is who we are as women, and that is our gift. So thank you for saying that. I am really disappointed to hear that women are feeling like they shouldn't follow their traditions because I think that's absolutely vital. And my own sense is in seeing people who are doing a lot of New Age things or getting into magic and so forth and doing a lot of Wicca and so forth, is all of that is really good. But what I perceive is that it lacks roots in tradition and ancestors. And that's huge. So it's absolutely vital that we go back and find our own traditions wherever we can. It's interesting. I was just reading Sandra Ingerman just before this talk, and she was talking about not being able to get her ancestral stories because her parents, you know, they on both sides, they, you know, some generations back, they came over and obliterated their history and just wanted to pass as American. And so those stories, she said, I feel such a loss and such an emptiness, and so I've journeyed inwardly to find my ancestors. Like, it's so, so important to know our ancestors, work with our ancestors, and not only our personal ancestors, but our racial ancestors, that's not the word I want, but for me, it's like my Lakota ancestry is vital. You know, it's like I can't, you know, and my Scottish ancestry, but I'm living and working and being on Turtle Island, and my Lakota ancestry just won't leave me alone, and I won't leave it alone. There's such depth. And every time I do a traditional ceremony, all my ancestors are there. They're all that they've woven into that ceremony over all those centuries is woven into that simple prayer, that simple ceremony. Every time I do it, I'm never praying alone. It has such depth. It's so, and you can feel that, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, but you can feel that when you feel that depth of a long tradition. Oh my gosh, there is no, everyone, yeah. especially the Hispanic tradition and the tradition out of Mexico is so rich. I just love when I'm around people who know something of that tradition and the things that I learn and the richness that I feel. And it's very different. It's more earthy and it's more grounded. So when we go with, like, our bodies are, in our bodies, we're made of seven generations of the past and seven generations of the future. So, you know, how our ancestors lived, what our ancestry is, it's to walk in that tradition is so much more grounding and it's so much more powerful and so much more healing to our ancestors as well. So I'm surprised to hear that. Thank you for asking that. Anything else you'd say about that?
Yeah, I find that what I am hearing from these Black and Brown women specifically is that because they're mixed with Spaniard or European, that for some reason, I find it's okay for an English person to know their lifeline back to the 1400s, but for some reason, Black and Brown women are being told, you know, that information's gone. And personally, my family told me, we don't know any of that. And I got into genealogy. I started reading a lot of books that are on Google Scholar. And I've connected with my ancestors, and I really want that for other people. But for some reason, we feel like maybe we're mixed with white, so we're not indigenous enough. So I'd love to hear you, since you're part Scottish, how you reconcile those two.
You know, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a ceremonial leader for years in one of our really big, in our Sundance ceremonies. And she doesn't have a drop of indigenous blood in her. And every once in a while, she'll say something about that. And I think, what are you kidding? You're so Indian.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, no, it's got nothing. I mean, it has everything to do with it and absolutely nothing to do with it. We don't know.
Right.
What, for all I know, she said every other past life she's ever had may have been as a Lakota, you know?
Exactly.
It's all deeply, no, we have a right to wherever our soul pulls us. And if we're of mixed heritage, then both of those heritages or all of those heritages feed us. So for me, you know, I get excited by, you know, the Druid craft tarot and learning about the Celtic, and partly because it's really the same. And I get excited about a lot of different traditions. I get excited about the Mexican curanderas and curanderos. I had a student in one of my classes at Herb Farm that was descended from generations of his grandmothers were all Mexican curanderas. And, oh, my gosh, I let him teach part of the class. It was so exciting because we can learn so much from another. But it's really important that, and I think for those of us of color, I'm actually white, but in my skin coloring. But that's patriarchy denying us that heritage. It's separation, you know, and it's rules and shoulds and it's rigid dogma, and
like a modern form of colonization.
It's a form of
exactly.
Colonization. Yeah,
that's what I find. And if I can just add one more little thing that I'm curious is that I think a lot of the confusion comes with closed practices, like for example smudging and just some of the native practices that are closed, or for example hoodoo, which is also closed. So I think it's understanding the difference of learning versus claiming, and understanding that some spiritual practices are open and some are closed. And I think people think that they must all be closed and they're closed off to all of us, although I don't believe that's so the case.
Oh, you know, that's an extreme of appropriation. It's become like kind of this thing that's really extreme, where there was one woman in one of my herb classes who was crying, and she said somebody told her that she was appropriating by studying herbal medicine. So she studies Echinacea and black cohosh, those are Native American herbs, and therefore she's appropriating. I'm like, oh my God. You know, that's crazy. So I think what we've done is we've taken appropriating to this kind of extreme. And, you know, really, on Turtle Island, the indigenous people had a prophecy in which they were told a time would come in which there were certain signs would come in which they would then go out and teach the children of the predominant people. So in the 1960s, those signs happened. And one of the things was that the young people of the predominant, of the white nation, basically, of the colonists, the young people would begin to dress and look like Indian people. And so you saw these men with long, you know, the young men wearing the long hair and putting bandanas on. And there were other signs as well. And many of the elders then came out and began sharing. And thank heaven that they did. And I one of my ancestors was just, when I was having some, being blocked from teaching and running into some challenges and so forth, one of my ancestors came to me, my Lakota ancestors, and he was enraged. And he said to me, we did not fight this hard to keep these things alive in order for them, for you not to get out and teach them. So these things are meant to be shared. And yes, there are some things that are closed, but smudging is like, that's not, are you saying that's one of the things people are saying is a closed practice?
Yeah, what is they're saying is that smudging is a closed practice, but that burning sage is not. So if you burn to cleanse, like smoke cleanse is okay, but saying that you're smudging is appropriation.
No, that's appropriation has become a dogma. No. No, these things were meant to be shared. And, you know, the Navajo woman that I studied with, a very famous medicine woman, made a point of sharing with people. She had classes that she did just for white people in which she would share sacred teachings and to help us all, because these teachings need to be shared so that we can all reclaim our indigenosity, and which is really our connection to the earth and to these old ways. And I actually, there is a man that should have been a very good friend of mine. His name is White Lightning, and he, Lakota man, and he came into my sweat lodge one time, and then he told me that, and then he gathered me together, he was doing some ceremonies, and he told me that he was bringing the ceremonies out so fully to the predominant world that his life was in danger from those who, you know, were angry and felt, you know, there's some controversy about that. Some people feel angry and they want to keep the ceremonies to themselves, but most of the elders will say, no, these things are not meant for one nation or one person. No, they're meant to be shared. They need to be shared with respect. You know, like appropriation is the kind of thing where I remember, anyway, let me finish with White Lightning. So anyway, he told me his life was in danger, and sure enough, he was murdered as a result of sharing these teachings. And so he made that sacrifice, like the muskrat, you know, am I going to like not share these things? Because, you know, he died to bring these things out for the people, and he knew his life was in danger, and he came forward as a warrior to keep sharing these teachings. Because if we don't reclaim these teachings and come together as one people, red, white, yellow, and black. You know, did I get all the colors right? I think so. I'm talking so fast.
It's okay. You tried.
but we have to stop all this infighting. And there's certainly, it. You know, when we learn from another culture and integrate that, we have to do it with respect and honoring those people and honoring those ancestors and giving back. Yeah. You know, if, for example, if somebody got together and they said, well, we're going to do a Lakota Sundance, you know, and they went out and kind of made it up and did it their own way, that's, first of all, very dangerous. And second of all, that would be totally appropriating it, calling it ours and stealing. But this is very different that we're talking about. These traditions have been opened up for a reason. I was just reading, and I can't remember which elder it was, and so I don't want to say his name, but a fairly famous Lakota medicine man was saying, you know, if we don't share these teachings, and we don't share these ceremonies, we don't share these ways, we'll lose them. But when we share them, they grow bigger, and we have more.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because that's what I've been saying, and what I've been telling people is, as long as you're not making money off of somebody else's culture, like, let's do a Lakota Sundance and charge $80 a ticket. That's wrong. But I do think that if we don't keep it alive, then who's going to do it? Like if it's, let's say we're 20% Native American, that's enough in my book for you to read about your ancestors and to learn. And maybe, you know, what I've been telling people is like, you know, for example, I'm Muisca, which is a tribe from South America. I'm Muisca, and I study herbs, and I've done some shamanic work here and there, but I don't call myself a Muisca shaman. Mm-hmm. So I'm just finding it, having these specifically.
Well, there's confusion out there, and certainly the word shaman is one of them, because, and that gets the Native people kind of irritated, because somebody who actually is a medicine person or a shaman, I mean, their lives are not their own. I mean, shamans go through so many trials, more than the average person or healer, and so that's an understanding. And I think there's a misunderstanding in the predominant culture where you go to school, you learn something, and now you can call yourself something, you know. In Native cultures, we have this understanding that anybody can do shamanic work, but not everybody is a shaman. And that misunderstanding causes appropriation. So we have to have some compassion also around that whole issue. It's a confusing issue, but I think what's happening is we're doing this kind of blame, beating people over the head kind of thing, and instead of having some open dialogue. And it's a very gray area. It's not black and white at all.
Do you think it's a fear of falling for people that maybe choose to claim certain cultures or certain rites? Like, I'm Gurandera, my mother was Gurandera, my grandmother was, and so on and so forth, and I've done genealogy, I know I have a strong tie to Aztecs, but when I try to teach someone about something simple like an egg, lumpia, and I tell them the importance of the egg and how it's a sacrifice, and they say it's weird or don't really want to understand the whole aspect of how I learned it, where I learned it, and then do it themselves, you think it's sort of like maybe a fear of falling or accepting themselves in a way?
I think it's a fear of falling in terms of losing their grip on what they think reality is. I think it's also, you know, this comes from the burning times too, is that all those old ways were viewed as superstition and weird and kind of dismissed. And yeah, so there is that in that kind of fear of opening up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird how much fear there is. Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those are great.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. My phone dropped, so I missed the last 60 seconds, but I really appreciate it. And I'm just really hoping that, you know, the younger generation really just steps into their power. And, you know, I think there's just that stigma of that's bad, that's juju. Like you said, it's make-believe. And yeah, so thank you for that. I really appreciate your
words.
Well,
you know, that's the other thing is we dismiss imagination as make-believe. And it's like, if you make-believe and you put enough intention in it, guess what? It might manifest.
Ta-da!
Yeah, the world of make-believe is, you know, a very real world. Imagination is a very real world. It's very, yeah. There was somebody who was telling me about I think it might have been Saban Fusume. I shouldn't quote her because I'm not sure. But no, I think it was her. Molly Doma Somme was talking about if they went back to their village and they talked about the idea of a fiction, that the concept doesn't even exist, of fiction. The people there can't even get their grips around it because as soon as you have a dream or you imagine something, it's happening somewhere. In some realm, somehow, somewhere it's happening. So, yeah, we're getting there. But, yeah, I know the feeling about the weird. I was just thinking that today, like, oh, my gosh, you know. Just feel like it's hard to walk in the world with this medicine because, you know, unless you're walking if you're fortunate enough to be walking among others that are, you know, of like mind, most of us are paving the way that are bringing these ways back. So good for you. Thank you for the way you're walking and thank you for your comments and questions. That was fabulous. I feel all excited.
Thank you. I'm just so happy I could talk to you. I really needed to hear your voice.
Well, thanks. I think I needed to hear yours too.
Perfect. Awesome.
Okay. Anybody else?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I had emailed one. It had to do, is ironic you started talking about St. John's wort oil, because about 2 weeks ago, that plant just kind of came into my consciousness. I also know that I'm a plant woman. And I am suffering from a lack of a menstrual cycle, which is interesting. And I really started to have my fall, we'll call it that, my fall in 2012, but I didn't lose my period till 2016. And I was very, very masculine, doing, definitely not honoring any of the feminine aspects of myself. And so I just really am curious about how that ties in, you know, the energetics and the medicine for St. John's wort. There's a teacher who is in Southern Oregon who teaches herbalism, but he teaches it via astrology and Ayurvedic nutrition.
Oh, I know who you mean, that fellow out on the Applegate.
Sajay Popham, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just have to say thank you, because as you're teaching today, I am like, oh my gosh, I'm home. And this is how this journey has been for me, because it is weaving perfectly, right? The story for each of us is weaving together. And so I know I'm a plant woman, and I'm also a hands-on healer, and, you know, been doing like reclaiming, and I went and did my journey with the ancestors. And it's interesting because that the I had mullein show up in my yard. It showed up by a mailbox and then in the yard after going to Southern Oregon to take our kids to this camp, which we used to live down there. And so the plants have the Lakota, from my understanding from a lecture from Susan Weed, is what shows up in your yard is what somebody needs in the house. And so I've been really watching my plants and seeing what shows up and waiting to identify it. So not just learning via the book, but also learning through the plant sits and being present and processing it.
Yes.
So St. John's wort, I didn't know what it looked like. And it was this shrub all through Oregon. And I was driving through Salem. And I was like, gosh, I really want to find a place to pull over and take a picture so I can plant snap it. And I did. And it was St. John of the Cross. So I've been studying all of the mystery schools, you know, the religions and how they weave together healing and sexuality and the feminine. And I was like, gosh, I wonder if this is St. John's wort. So I just had these impressions and I would look them up and then I was confirming it, right? Like, yes, that is. And
that's fun.
Yes, it's so fun. And then I had a whole week of lemons. People, my niece stole a lemon and just all of this lemon action. And I looked up the meaning of lemon and it brings more light in and it's cleansing and mint showed up. So St. John's wort, I'm feeling like that's definitely a message for me to use, but I'm curious because I literally quit menstruating after being very in shape and very healthy and a very normal cycle, like cold turkey. and my doctor's like, oh, you're in menopause. And I'm like, that just does not feel right or true.
How old are you?
I am now 44.
Menopause starts 50, no earlier, unless you're
so this is the scientific reductive. Yeah, and I know that there has been a huge purification in my marriage. So like the unseen realms, like we're pulling in information right into our bodies.
Can I interrupt you for a second, because we're actually out of time? And so can we make this concise? One thing I might suggest to you is, and it's nice to hear all your excitement about the plants, because that's another huge thing, is reconnecting with the plants and really connecting with them as people, as a part of what we've lost through all of this. But in terms of, like, not having your moon time, what I would suggest is pick the new or full moon and do your moon time ceremony during that period.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can remember whether you menstruated on the full or the moon, or the new moon, then at least until you're 50, just keep doing that ceremony with the moon.
As
if you were off the moon, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for all your comments. Sorry to shut you off. Do we have very many more questions, Lauren?
No, there's no more questions. And it's 8 o'clock.
Okay. Boy, we ran it right down to the wire. Thank you so much for all your enthusiasm and your questions and all your, great comments and so much wisdom, and I feel really excited by this circle of women, so thank you all of you for being here tonight, and I'll turn it over to Lauren. Oh, you know what? Can I release the spirits? I think there's a lot of goddesses here that I didn't even invoke. You all brought them in. So we thank you all for being here. Well, cosmic spirits of all the four directions above and below, and especially all these grandmother spirits, all these goddesses. We thank you for the way that you've walked and held this medicine. We thank you for the ways in which you've lived your lives, and we thank you for being here with us tonight. The world before us is restored in beauty. Actually, everybody unmute themselves and say this after me. Ready? The world before me is restored in beauty.
The world before me is restored in beauty.
The world behind me is restored in beauty.
The world behind me is restored in beauty.
The world below me is restored in beauty.
The world below me is restored in beauty.
The world above me is restored in beauty.
The world above me is restored in beauty.
Our voices are restored in beauty.
Our voices are restored in beauty.
And then together we will say, it is finished in beauty, four times. It is finished,
it is
in,
finished
beauty.
In beauty.
It is finished in beauty. It is finished in beauty. It is finished in beauty. It is finished in beauty.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to Lauren.
Thank you.
Blessed be.
Blessed be. Thank you, Dancer. Just a few logistics, y'all, before you hop off. The recording for tonight's call will be up on Dancing Crow's website, which is drdeborahfrancis.com by the end of the week. And if you would, please do share it with anybody that you know who might receive benefit or medicine from it. Also, if you would share future emails and future gatherings that Dancing Crow is doing, that would also be great. If you're not on her email list, go ahead and send an email to that dancingcrowherbs@yahoo.com and just say that you want to get on her newsletter. And the newsletter we just send out like a couple days before these calls so that you can hop on. Also, Dancing Crow offers these calls for free. However, she gratefully accepts donations via PayPal. So there's a couple ways you can send donations. One is to go to her website, which is drdeborahfrancis.com, and there's a send donations page that you can find, and you can send donations through there, or you could just go to PayPal and then send it to the following email, which is different than the one I've been saying. It's deborah.francis@yahoo.com. That's on PayPal. And no amount is too small and no amount is too large. And she is so grateful for all the donations she receives and wants to thank everybody that has sent them so far. They really, really, really do help. Also, Dancing Crow works, she maintains a practice via phone. So she does naturopathic consults and shamanic healing sessions and shamanic mentoring. So if you or anyone that you know would benefit from working with her in that way, then I highly recommend it. And you can either send an email or give her a phone call. Her contact info is on her website. And I believe that's it. So Dancing Crow, I know that I'm speaking on behalf of everybody on the call by just saying thank you. Thank you so much. This was so rich and deep and also really, really uplifting. I feel really, I don't know, goddess juiced up and inspired. So thank you so much for taking the time. And we're all so grateful.
Well, I'm grateful too, because I feel like all I did was create a space and all these women brought all these powerful spirits in. So thank you back to all of you.